Around the world, there are more than 200 million believers that face high levels of persecution because of their faith. Situations like that. There's people in our church who have faced situations like that. This last year, 3,066 Christians were killed for their faith. And that was double the number than the year before. 1,252 people were abducted. 1,020 were raped or sexually harassed. And 793 churches were attacked. That means that for every 12 people here, there will be one person that's persecuted. That's staggering. That's overwhelming. It's troubling. And Jesus calls us, his people, a body, a connected body. We're all in this together. And we don't want to be a dismembered body, disconnected from each other. We know that we are inextricably connected to the persecuted brothers and sisters around the world. We live out the same story. And that's why we pray. And we must pray for them. In fact, if you're passionate about praying for the persecuted church, there is a group of FAC heroes that gather monthly to pray. You can get more information on that out on Main Street after the service. This weekend, though, we have heard all kinds of stories of persecution. And as many as they are, they barely scratch the surface. From the very, very beginning, to follow Jesus meant to put everything on the line. We know that out of the 11 disciples alive at the time of Jesus ascending to heaven, that all of them but one were killed for their faith. And the one that wasn't killed, they did try to kill. They boiled him and banished him to an island. You carry on in the story of Acts and you see that anyone who identified as a follower of Jesus, who belonged to the sect called the Way, were hunted for their faith. And it didn't get much easier. In Hebrews 11, verse 36, we read that some faced jeers and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawed in two. They were killed by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, living in caves and in holes in the ground. Shortly after this, in Hebrews 11, we know from church history that under Nero, Christians were lit on fire and used as streetlights. And the persecution continued. In 303 AD, the greatest persecution under Decius broke out against Christians. At the beginning of Acts, we know that there were hundreds of followers of Jesus. We don't know exactly, but it was in the hundreds. In 310 AD, with ongoing extreme persecution, we know that there were 6 million believers in the Roman Empire. From a couple hundred to 6 million. That kind of growth is staggering. It's exponential. It's beautiful. And I think it's enough to make us go, well, how? How? There was a man in the 1900s that tried to wipe out Christianity. His name was Yemelyan Yaroslavsky. And after trying to wipe out Christianity, he came to this conclusion and he said that Christianity is like a nail. The harder you strike it, the deeper it goes. Christianity is like a nail. The harder you strike it, the deeper it goes. Perhaps that's part of the reason why Jesus says we're blessed when we're persecuted. We're blessed when people say all kinds of things against us. We're blessed when people come against us because of our faith, because it makes our faith more real, more intimate, more immediate, more deep. And yet, for most of us in this room right now, in many ways, we just don't have anything remotely close to this level of persecution. It's almost a persecution-less faith. So in the moments we have together, I want us to look at, well, then how do we live? In light of the situation around the world and in light of where God has called us to be here in Canada, Alberta, and Calgary, how then shall we live? What do we do? And to help us, I want to look at the story of the very first martyr, a man named Stephen. And his story is in Acts chapter 6 and 7. And in Acts chapter 6, we're going to read in verse 3 and 4. The church was growing exponentially. The church was growing quickly. And we read this, verse 3. Brothers and sisters, choose 7 men from among you who are known to be full of the Spirit and wisdom. We will turn this responsibility over to them and will give our attention to prayer and the ministry of the word. And Stephen was one of the 7 chosen for the role. So we know that he was full of the Spirit and he was full of wisdom. What's interesting to note with Stephen was that he was a Hellenistic Jew. That meant that he was a Greek Jew. That meant that he was brought in. He was an outsider brought to the inside. He was identified as a man that loved Jesus. And further validating his character, Acts 6:8 says that Stephen, a man full of God's grace and power, performed great wonders and signs among the people. So he was godly. He was full of the Spirit. He was full of grace. He was full of power. He was actively engaged in ministry. And we read that the more and more and more ministry that he did, the more and more and more the Jewish leaders were trying to take him down. We read in verse 10 that they were trying to argue, the Jews were trying to argue with Stephen and debate with him, but we read that they could not stand up against the wisdom that God gave Stephen. God gave Stephen everything he needed to do everything that he was being called to. He was given words from God to have an answer. So they keep on trying to take Stephen down. It didn't work, so they tried to remove his credibility. They tried to take him out, nullify his ministry, and they bribed people to speak ill of Stephen. So they would, you know, hey, we'll give you this if you come and just take Stephen out. And you just, like, bash his character, bash his theology, bash his understanding. Just, we'll take care of you if you take care of Stephen. And we read that eventually they drug Stephen before the Sanhedrin, the highest court in the land. And when Stephen is before the Sanhedrin, we were told that the high priest asks Stephen, hey, is this true? Is what all of these people that have been bribed, is what they're saying, is that true about you? And Stephen, in his response, jumps into this beautiful monologue about the entire history of God's people. That's what Acts chapter 7 is, Stephen's response. I won't read the whole thing because it'll take me 12 minutes just to read his response. But what I want to do is I want to highlight some of the things that he does, and then I think we can learn a lot from his response. But in Acts chapter 7, Stephen walks through the history of God's people. He starts with Abraham, and he says, Abraham lived by faith. He trusted in God's promise. He goes on to Isaac and then to Jacob, and he starts talking about the 12 tribes, the 12 sons that would become the 12 tribes. He starts talking about Joseph. He starts talking about Moses and the wilderness wanderings. He goes through the whole history of God's people, of Israel, right up until and including Jesus. And he talks about how Jesus is the fulfillment. He's the promised Messiah. He is the righteous one. He is the one that all of their ancestors had always been looking forward to. And then Stephen so boldly says, and he's the one that you betrayed and murdered. The one that you were waiting for, the Messiah, the Christ, the promised one, you betrayed and murdered him. And in response, the Sanhedrin killed Stephen. It's bold. It's a powerful story, and there's so much for us to learn in it. In this encounter, the stakes were never higher for Stephen than right here. He was literally on trial for his life. And he takes zero effort in defending himself. Now, if people are maligning our character, bashing us, people have been bribed to take us down, and someone says, is that true? It's like, no, that's not true. And Stephen doesn't do that. Stephen just takes the opportunity, I'm going to talk about the beauty, the glory, the majesty, the life-changing power and presence of Jesus. It's interesting to me that this was Stephen's last defense, and there was absolutely no self-defense in it. Just talking about Jesus. I remember a mentor years ago challenging me by saying that tough times don't create character nearly as much as they reveal character. And Stephen, for his whole journey with Jesus, had been making investments in his spiritual character and in his walk with Jesus. You know, what the question is, like, when you get squeezed, what comes out? When you're in a hard situation, what's the natural response? And we see when Stephen got squeezed, all that came out was the glory, the beauty, the majesty, and the story of Jesus. When we get squeezed, when we're in a hard place, what comes out? Stephen just talks and points people to Jesus. Now, for many of us here this morning, we're living in a season of persecution less faith. May we be a people that are choosing to make the investments in our lives, in our walk with Jesus, so that if or when the tough times come, what comes out is the glory of Jesus. How do we do that? How do we get there? How do we live well now? Well, Alistair McIntyre once said, I cannot answer the question, what ought I to do, unless I first answer the question of which story am I a part of? Which story am I a character in? In that video we watched a few moments ago, they said that we live the story of our Savior, of our family throughout history and throughout the world today. We live the story of Jesus. We need to understand that we are characters, we are vital people in the story of God's work here on earth. We're united. We're one church, one faith, one baptism, one body. It's why we're doing this series. We're one church, and we're a part of the story of God here on earth. We are connected to our brothers and sisters around the planet that are being persecuted. We're connected to each other. We're all part of the story of God's mission on earth. And may we live our lives with the purpose of Jesus, following Him. Trusting Him, serving Him, and knowing Him. We read on in Acts chapter 7, and after Stephen goes through a lot of the history of God's people, in verse 57 and 58 we read, at this they covered their ears, and yelling at the top of their voices, they all rushed at Him. Dragged Him out of the city and began to stone Him. Meanwhile, the witnesses laid their coats at the feet of a young man named Saul. And then at the very end, we read, Saul approved of their killing him. There was a young man who approved of the killing of Stephen. He was there. They laid their coats at his feet while they went and killed Stephen. Now this Saul, a couple chapters later, would come to see Jesus himself. And he would become known as Paul. And this Paul wrote 13 books of the New Testament. And this Paul preached to thousands and thousands of people the story of Jesus. And this Paul mentored young leaders, young pastors, young business people. This Paul prayed for people. This Paul saw Jesus move in amazing ways. This Paul encouraged people. And this Paul ended up giving his life in service for Jesus. But the thing is that Stephen never saw a moment of it. Stephen never saw a sniff of the impact of his faithfulness, of his preaching, of his life, of his story. Stephen influenced Saul. There's no way he didn't. And yet, Stephen never would know the impact of his faithfulness to Jesus in the life of a young man named Saul, who would go on to change the entire spiritual landscape of the Roman Empire and beyond. Here's the thing, church. There are all kinds of Sauls in our world. And we have no idea the ability that we have to impact or influence people for Jesus. They may be like Saul, the most murderous, grumpy, approving of our persecution people that we know. And we have an opportunity and an invitation to influence and impact people out of the overflow of our lives. Out of the overflow of our living for Jesus, we have the capacity to influence and impact people. Stephen never saw the impact or influence of his faithfulness, and we may not see ours, but may that not deter us from living faithfully the story of Jesus here on earth. May we take a stand for him, for Jesus, to reach people with the gospel, the good news. Also at the end of Acts chapter 7, we read some of Stephen's very last words, starting in verse 55. But Stephen, full of the Holy Spirit, looked up to heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. Look, he said, I see heaven open and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. At this, they covered their ears and yelling at the top of their voices, they all rushed at him, dragged him out of the city and began to stone him. So Stephen, at the very end, he says, I see Jesus. And it's beautiful to note that when Stephen, before the Sanhedrin, says, I see heaven open and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God, it matches Jesus' very words that Jesus spoke to the Sanhedrin when he was on the trial for his life. In Matthew 26, verse 64, Jesus says to the Sanhedrin, to the same people, from now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Father. And so Stephen here is saying to the same group of people, I see Jesus. He is where he said he would be. He's doing what he said he would be doing. He is who he says he is. I see Jesus. I see his glory. And it's wonderful. I see him. And the response is they gnash their teeth at him and they kill him. And he's just testifying that Jesus is who he says he is and he does what he says he will do. That his promises are always yes. There's one more thing that's really interesting with this statement that we need to note to bring it all together. Stephen, he says, I see heaven open and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of the Father. Now that's a slight variation from every other instance in the Bible. Psalm 47 says, God is sitting on his throne. Isaiah 6:1 says, I see the Lord high and exalted, seated on a throne. Colossians 3:1, Christ is seated at the right hand. Isaiah 40:22, God sits enthroned. Revelation 4, thanks to him who sits on the throne. Matthew 19, the Son of Man sits on his glorious throne. Stephen, I see heaven open and the Son of Man standing. What's that about? Well, they're in the Roman Empire. And everyone there knew what kings would do and king behavior. And every person there knew in the Roman Empire when soldiers returned home from war that the king would stand to honor them. Every person there would have known that when a fallen soldier returned home from battle, that the king would stand to honor the fallen soldier. We see here Jesus standing and saying, Stephen, I see you, well done, good and faithful servant. Welcome home, my soldier. I love you and I see you. And Jesus stands to honor his servant. And church, we don't get to pick how we die, but we all get to pick how we live. And may we be a church that chooses to stand for Jesus, to live our lives for him, to say, Jesus, we live for you, wherever, whenever, however, to whomever, wherever you call us, we will go. We live our lives for you. Like that song Michelle beautifully sang for us. Our joy is your cause, Jesus. Our joy is the cause of Jesus. C.S. Lewis says that you should die before you die because it's the only chance you have. May we be a church that have died to self and found our life in Jesus and living our life for his purposes in such a way that when FAC, when we go and see Jesus, he says, well done, church. Well done, good and faithful servants. Well done. Welcome home. Thank you for your service. The world has been changed. Welcome home. Welcome home. I've been waiting. And we get to heaven and we see our persecuted brothers and sisters. We've been praying for you. And they say, we know. We know. Let's live our lives in service of Jesus. We don't want to do this flippantly. We want to choose. And so we want to take a couple of seconds to be still before Jesus and say, where, who, how, why, where are you calling us to go? How can your cause be my joy? So let's take a few moments and pray and talk to Jesus.